The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, honored to be joined today by retired Navy Captain William Peacock, veteran of World War II. Sir, you joined the Navy shortly after Pearl Harbor. Where did your training take you, and how did it ultimately get you to the ship you were on during the war?
Well, I was co-oping at Georgia Tech in December the 7th, 1941, when the war broke out and the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And of course, like all the other young guys, I thought maybe I want to get onto a PT boat and sink Japanese ships. However, I continued in my studies at Georgia Tech and co-oping, putting in gas appliances in Macon, Georgia, living in a boarding house on Georgia Avenue. And I had a dirty job putting in these appliances, crawling up under low houses and putting in water heaters, stoves, refrigerators, and floor furnaces. And Grady Jones, my master plumber, was actually drafted and left me with the job, and I had to put in about three houses a day with a weapons carrier. And when I got to Georgia Avenue at night, I lived in a bunkhouse in the back, and we had a lot of guys that lived there, and we had two meals a day with breakfast, and they made me a lunch to take on the job with me. And at night, I came back to Georgia Avenue. We'd have a Lazy Susan out there for everybody to get what they could. And I was having a hard time getting everything I needed to eat. And so one day when I was walking home from my job, I noticed the Navy recruiting station. The Navy recruiter had a sign that he had printed himself. I've never seen it advertised. It said, "Join the Navy, three hot meals a day." So I proceeded to go in and join the Navy. And then they sent me up to Newport, Rhode Island. I went through boot camp there. Then I went through quartermaster school, graduated there December the 5th, 1942. And from there, I was sent to Solomon's Island for training in amphibious force and to form crews. And we went down to Charleston, South Carolina. And I became a charter member of LST 357. And I actually pulled a commission pennant up on the LST 357 on February the 8th, 1943. And we did practice maneuvers, and we went out and did gun firing, and finally the crew was ready to go up to New York. And we went up by Cape Hatteras, which is a graveyard of ships. The water was pretty rough, but we made it up there, and we got to Portsmouth, Virginia. It was near Valentine's Day, so I went ashore and got some Valentines to send home to my folks. And when I came back, the water was pretty rough out there, and not too many boats were going out. But one coxswain said, "I'll be ready to take the boats out. Take anybody that wants to go back to their ship, I'll take them." And I said, "I'll go." And I got on the boat, but he went out, and actually there were about 10 or 15 of us on the boat. And he ran into the side of an LST, and the ramp came down, and the boat went down like a rock. We were all out there in the water, and there was a lot of white hats floating around, but somebody managed to get me when I got up to an LST and put my arm through a cargo net. Somebody came down and put a rope around my waist and pulled me up on the ship. A few days later, they got me back to LST 357, and we proceeded on to go up the beach to Baltimore and then to Philadelphia and then to Bayonne, New Jersey, where we loaded with ammunition. That's an all-hands evolution. So the Baker flag goes up, the red flag. The officers and all the men loaded the ammunition. From there, we went down Ambrose Channel and went down the coast again to Bermuda Island. We got to Bermuda Island. There were several of the men on the ship that got seasick because the ship rolled and rocked, and it was kind of tough. I never got seasick at all on all my duty on that ship because I was on the top side. And we had to get rid of some of the officers because they couldn't take it. And actually, the chief boatswain mate named Williams, he had to come off because he was spent a lot of his time heaving up. You know, he couldn't stand the rough ride on an LST, probably on a cruiser or a battleship before. So from there, we proceeded to Gibraltar. And we got. It took us about almost 30 days to from the time we left Ambrose Channel to get to Gibraltar. And in Gibraltar, there was a commander on a ship who went to Annapolis, and he was a good tennis player. And he said, "Does anybody on board play tennis? I'd like to have a game with him." I said, "Yeah, I used to play tennis." And so I went ashore with him, and I played tennis with him, and sure enough, he beat me. And so we went over to Joe's Bar and had a beer. We came back to then we came back to the ship. And then we went to several ports all over the coast of North Africa. We went to Arzu, Mostaganem, Oran. And finally, we proceeded to go to our home port, Bazerte, North Africa. It so happened that as we went into Bazerte, the Germans and the Italians were leaving. They were flying out, and we took shots at them. I'm not too sure whether we hit a couple of planes or not. Gunner's mate tells me we shot at least two of the planes down coming out of Bazerte. They left from... These were guys that Montgomery's was driving the Germans in toward Bazerte there, and Patton was coming in the other way. And when we got close to Bazerte to get into the port, to the Lake of Bazerte, on our port side, there was a small, that looked like a subcarrier, a subchaser. Something happened to that boat. It got hit, and it went down like a rock. But I don't know if anybody could have survived that, but... The Germans, I guess, they thought they had enough ships sunk into the harbor going into the Lake of Bazerte that we couldn't get in there. But the LST, you know, it let the ballast out of the tanks, and the ship rises up out of the water. Of course, when we're at sea, we have about 14-foot draft aft and about 9 feet forward. But going into the beach, about 3 foot forward and about 9 feet aft. So we made it into the harbor as all the other LSTs did. That was our home port, Bazerte, North Africa. So that was our home port, and we did our training going into Tunisia, did practice landings there for the invasion of Lucada, Sicily. Now, that was where we made our first invasion. And we were very fortunate in that the British were very, very smooth in trying to deceive the Germans on where we were going. And there's a story about a man who never was, and the British had a Godiva that they planted off the coast of Spain and fooled the Germans into believing that he had a satchel signed by Churchill and Roosevelt that we were going into Greece. So the Germans were vacating Italy. They were vacating Sicily, and it made it an easier invasion for us. Otherwise, I might not be here today, because if the Germans had stayed there. But this is a true story about this man who never was. You can find it on Google. But
how fierce was the fight at Sicily?
It wasn't that fierce, as far as I could see, because. But there was one bad thing about it. A lot of the planes that were flying over, there was not a lot of communications, probably. And we didn't have too much of a problem there. But what we did, we loaded on wounded and prisoners. But the ship down from us was hit by a Messerschmitt, German Messerschmitt, right midships. And a friend of mine, his wife, Rathia Joy, says her husband was on that ship, and he dove into the water because he was a good swimmer. But he was picked up, and he was taken to another boat, and finally got back to shore, and they assigned him to another LST, where he went to the Pacific. But it wasn't that bad. In the water was rough going in there, but when we got in close enough, it was very smooth when we hit the beach there at Lucada, Sicily. So we made about 18 trips, I guess, back and forth between North Africa, different ports back and forth, and before we made arrangements to go into Salerno, Italy. And we actually hit Licata, Sicily on the 10th of July, 1943. And we did a lot of practice landings, and we were told that we were going to carry, we were going to be lend-leased to the British to go into Salerno, Italy. So we went to Tripoli, North Africa, and we loaded with Hampshire Regiment. They were really Scottish guys, they called, and they were nicknamed the Desert Rats. And they were really tough guys. They went through El Alamein under Montgomery, and those guys were tough. As a matter of fact, I kind of liked them a little bit for this reason. One of the sergeants came up on the top deck, and he asked me, he said, where can I get some fruit cocktail? So I managed with the cook to get a gallon can of fruit cocktail, and he gave me a bottle of Scotch whiskey. I didn't use it all myself, but they were good guys. And it's just one of those things, a relationship that you build with people. Sometimes it pays off, and in this case, it certainly did. So we finished that. We got, when we went into Salerno, Italy, tried to get into the beach twice, but the German 88s up in the hills were so fierce that the beachmaster waved us off, and we couldn't get in, so we went out, and we thought we were out of range of the 88s, and we dropped anchor out there, and while we were out there, Stratton was coming down like black rain, and the little boat on the port side contained a Lieutenant J.G. from the Coast Guard named Gill, and he was trained on a submarine with the British to figure out where to hit the beach with the LCVPs of all the small boats going into the beach. He was trained to get all those beach LCVPs into the beach safely. And he practiced for about 3 months, and he decided on the Star Capella. Now, he was the only person that could do this. But when the Stratton was coming down, one of the guys in that little boat on the port side, it was never lowered because the cables were frayed. And Lieutenant Gill was also hit, but he was not killed. The other guy was killed. So one of the stretcher bearers went up there, and another one went up there with him in a wire basket, and they put him in it. They were trying to get him out, and they asked for help. I came out of the wheelhouse because we were anchored, and I was waiting for the word to go in. I helped them get him out to get him down to the wardroom. And in the meantime, the skipper got hit. Lieutenant George Bond, he got hit, and the stretcher bearer Jackson was another guy was helping to get him down there too. So Jackson came through the wheelhouse. I slapped him on the back. I said, "Jackson, you've been hit." He had blood all over my hand, and so Jackson was taking the skipper down to the wardroom for the doctors to get the shrapnel out of him, which he did. But George Vaughn had to be transferred to another off of that ship, and Lieutenant McLeod took over his place as the skipper of the ship. But we still made about 18 trips back and forth to Italy in Naples, and on one of the trips from Oran, North Africa, we carried French doctors and nurses, and their attendants were Arab guys that. The attendants, like nurses, attending with the other nurses. And, so these Arabs were.
Captain, let me stop you right there. We need to take a quick break in our segments here, but we'll pick up the story in just a moment on Veterans Talk.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. I'm honored to be joined today by Navy Captain William Peacock, veteran of World War II. We've been talking about his work aboard LST 357, about its commissioning, its work in North Africa, Sicily, and now Salerno, Italy, which was the first Allied landing in mainland Europe. That was in September of 1943. And, sir, you were just telling us a story about the French doctors and their Arab helpers coming up to deal with the casualties at Salerno.
We carried them into Naples, Italy, and it was a very pleasant trip because they were all very cordial to us, and they could speak mostly English. And there were no casualties on the ship when they were on the ship with us. We strictly delivered them to Naples, Italy. So there's a lot of rumors about how many casualties there were going into Salerno. Some say 90 casualties, 40 casualties. But the release from the Navy, when I was on leave, gave me a list of said there was 90 casualties going into Salerno. And that would have to include the British desert rats that went in. So, but well, the thing about it, when we were on Salerno Beach, after we delivered, after we left, the French nurses and doctors in Naples, Italy, I want to go back to where we were stuck on the beach at Salerno and couldn't get off. While we were on the beach, the British were unloading their tanks and they were putting down a metal mash in front, and Tom Sullivan said he saw the young British guys putting down the mesh and had a sledgehammer putting spikes in there so that the mesh would be taut and the tanks wouldn't slip. So he said, you'd have to put a gun to my head to go down there and do that type of work, because every time a guy would get up there to use a sledgehammer, a sniper on a hill would shoot him. And he said that was a tough deal. But finally, we did get an LCI to pull us from the back, and we would reverse the starboard and port engine, and we would heave in on the stern anchor. And finally, we got off the beach after several hours. And then we'd go back and forth about 18 times from North Africa to whatever port we were sent to some other place in Italy. So we enjoyed every trip that we made, because there was no time for any no time for anything but work.
Yeah, clearly. But
we were actually during those times we were 4 hours on and 4 hours off on duty. And I remember one time I went down to get a guy to relieve me. So on a small ship, you stand when you're underway. A small ship, a quartermaster stands both signal watch, blinker light, semaphore, and flag hoist. And I did those duties also.
Talk a little more about what the quartermaster does and how the LST operated, hauling and delivering the tanks to amphibious landings.
Okay. My job was to take care of the navigational charts, to keep a log of everything that took place everywhere we landed and so forth, which I have. And take care of the chronometer and the psychrometer and the weather vanes to determine what the weather was going to be and what the current is, and to give the skipper of the ship or whoever has the conning tower or control of the ship where we were, longitude and latitude. And I had to take terrestrial sightings. I took celestial sightings of stars, sunlines, and determined the latitude and longitude of the ship. All this was reported to the officer of the deck as he came in to take over the conning tower. And and whatever questions he had about anything that we, any other ships, any other buoys or what have you, in the path of our course. And I plotted courses on the charts, and he would verify whether I did them correctly or not, which mostly I did. And with that, and actually at night, in the blinker light, we had a little gun with a little hole in the end of it, and you could say, you know, like dit 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 da da da, dit dit dit, like SOS, save our souls, and you would point that directly at the ship that you were signaling to, and of course in the daytime we used the big blinker light, you know, and then we had the flag, the hoisting of the flags for certain movements of the ship and for certain dignitaries on board. And we had one man that was on a signal man named Watkins, and he used to sleep in the flag bag because he thought that was the safest place to sleep. And
and then in terms of what the LST did.
The LST, when we went into the beach, about 2.5 lengths, we would drop the stern anchor. The anchor chain, the cable is 900 feet long. So we didn't want to lose the anchor, so we would make sure we knew what the tides were, and we knew what the beach was like. We would have to know what the beach was like. And you had to land the LST perpendicular to the beach, make sure the stern didn't swing, and make sure that you had the bow doors open and ramp down in a proper way before when we hit the beach. So you had to have the right ballast in your tanks. So when we hit some times you'd hit at different speeds, say flank speed or standard speed. Well, we happened to hit the beach at standard speed. That's the last word I got from the skipper before he got hit with shrapnel. We got fully up on the beach. And what you do is the tanks go off, they would put more ballast in the front to keep the front end of the ship down, you know. And also, you would make sure that you had the stern anchor was kept taut to keep the ship from wiggling back and forth. And I had to keep the engines going and the rudder to make sure that the LST stayed perpendicular to the beach and that the tanks didn't have any problems getting off of the LST. The soldiers would come down out of there before we made a landing. They would come down and test their tanks, and we'd turn on the ventilators and make sure that we didn't have any carbon dioxide in the tank deck. And all the soldiers had started their tanks and make sure they run properly, because you didn't want any of them to stall going off of the ramp. We did that before we went into the beach, and we never had a problem with anything getting stalled to keep us from unloading properly.
Well, we talked about the landing at Salerno. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about a much bigger amphibious landing, the one at Normandy.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Yeah.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network. Radio America and the American Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
Welcome back. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, honored to be joined today by retired Navy Captain William Peacock, veteran of World War II. We've been talking about his service aboard LST-357. We've talked about the critical landing at Salerno over the past couple of segments. After that, LST-357 was repurposed over to the United Kingdom in preparation for the Allied landings at Normandy, otherwise known as D-Day. Tell us what your ship's role was in that invasion.
Yes. Our ship's role was to carry American troops into the beach at Omaha Beach on D-Day, June 6th. In preparation for that invasion, we went to Londonderry, Ireland to change the 3-inch gun we had on the stern to 40 millimeters, twin 40 millimeters, and to put 40 millimeters on the bow and additional armament of 20 millimeters. And while we were there in Londonderry, Ireland, I had my tonsils removed. And the way you did that, you stand in line, and a medic comes up and freezes your tonsil. He sticks a needle in each tonsil and freezes it. And then you sit in a metal chair. You have a commander and a lieutenant who is training to take the tonsils out. So mine were well frozen when I sat in the metal chair. And he took one tonsil out okay, and he let the trainer take the other one out. But he didn't get the cat gut around there too good. And so when I got back to my LST, I was on one of the side, on the port side, laying down in one of the bunks that the soldiers usually use. And one of the guys came in there telling jokes, and I got to laughing, and one of my tonsils veins started bleeding real bad, and they had to put me in a weapons carrier to go back to the Quonset hut. And when he got back to Quonset hut, the commander then perfectly secured the cat gut around that tonsil and started feeding me eggnog, and I stayed overnight and then went back to the LST. I didn't want to miss the invasion. See. Then we went down and did a lot of practice landings in England before we made the invasion. But the thing about it was the weather was real bad when we were going to go on the 5th of June. And the weather was so bad that Eisenhower called it off, and we didn't get to go in on that time. But we did load up with troops and we were ready to go. But we got out a little way, and the water was so rough that a lot of the guys were throwing up. A lot of the soldiers got sick. And we were a little bit thankful. It gave us a chance to clean up the ship and then get ready for the actual invasion. So when we got the word, we proceeded to, in a way, actually, I think the Germans thought we were going to Calais, or that we were going to go into another invasion point, because we made a turn. Almost a left-angle turn, 90 degrees, like we were headed toward Calais. And then, actually Hitler pulled his troops back to Calais, and it was on account of that, and probably on account of a dummy invasion by General Patton that we were going to hit Calais. But we also aided him in that, in directing in our ship in that direction. So then we were directed straight toward the beach at Omaha, but we couldn't go in there because the water was so rough that you couldn't get that boat, LST on the beach and keep the stern properly and the ship 90 degrees to the beach. So this was on June the 6th, and finally we were anchored out and to unload what we did. We opened the bow doors and we lowered the ramp, and we had 16 ducks on there. We had 16 ducks on there, and we unloaded the ducks, and then the LCBPs. We had 6 LCBPs, 3 on each side, except the one that Lieutenant Gill was in was supposed to be the guide. He wasn't there now. This was at Omaha Beach, and we had 6 LCVPs that we lowered into the water, and they rendezvoused in preparation for going into the beach. So then after that, we started using the elevator to unload the top deck, and the elevator was taking all of the ambulance and all of the trucks and supplies and logistics and loading them onto a Rhino ferry. And the Rhino ferry was loaded, and after we got all of that done, the Rhino ferry was cut loose from the LST, and we were free to go. But the thing about it was, somehow or another, we got a cable wrapped around one of the screws, and they wanted a volunteer to go down to see if he could get the cable. And Alvin Hess, who died here on the 16th of June, he was a gunner's mate on my ship, he volunteered, and he went down and actually freed that cable so that screw was free to turn. So we made our way back to England with another convoy. And we got back in on our second trip on the 9th of June. We started back to go to Omaha Beach. And on this trip, there was five LSTs. And as we were going across, there were E-boats came out of Cherbourg. And unlike a submarine that fires a torpedo at a lower depth in the water, the E-boats could fire them on the surface. And they had perfect shot to LST 314, which was sunk, and LST 376, which was sunk. Well, we could hear them screaming, and we could see the fire and everything, but we couldn't stop because we were, would be a duck, we'd be a sitting duck ourselves. So we had to proceed on hoping that the rescue boats would pick these guys up. And it was a hard thing to do, but we had to go on. And we did hit the beach on that time, and we got on there properly, and we unloaded, and we were we got the word that the Focke-Wulfs were coming over, dropping bombs, trying to hit the LSTs also, and other ships coming into the beach, and the guys up on Du Hoc, the cliff there. The word got out. If you hear the German Focke-Wulf, it's not going to hit you. But if you don't hear him, so that's kind of worrisome, because if you don't hear him, you think, well, he's going to hit. But you hear him, he didn't hit you with his bomb. So we made about after that we made it. We finally got off the beach there. We were high and dry for a while. And I have a picture of us on the beach there that I can give you. We went back to England, and we made about, I guess, 20 or 30 trips across before I was given orders to go back to the States. And then I was sent to Glasgow, Scotland, after that invasion of Omaha Beach.
Let's talk about the first day on Omaha Beach, June 6th. Obviously, it's become well known over the years that the early hours of the full military operation were very chaotic, very difficult. That's where the German resistance was fiercest. What did you see from your vantage point? What time were you there, and then how fierce was the fighting still?
Well, I wasn't on the beach, of course. I couldn't see the fighting there. But I saw a lot of ships, and I saw a lot of guys floating in the water. And I saw a lot of people when we hit the beach. There was a lot of people that were casualties on the beach, which our ship almost became a hospital ship, carrying people back and prisoners too. And so what we did, we would load down with prisoners and wounded people and take them back to England, Portsmouth usually. So
one of the things you also mentioned, of course, back more during the Italian campaigns, is that LST 357 was temporarily under British control,
right,
for those operations. And so perhaps as a result of that, most likely as a result of that, in the years that followed, there was some discrepancy about what your ship accomplished, and you worked very hard to set the record straight about what you and your colleagues contributed and achieved during the war, correct?
Yes. Well, actually, we weren't given credit for going into Salerno, and my son was in the Naval Academy at the time, and they had an archives there. And he went over to the archives, and he found a picture of LST 357 on the beach at Salerno. And that was in the archives at the Naval Academy. They don't have an archives there now. But from that picture, I was convinced that the Navy, I wrote to the Dictionary of American Fighting Ships and to the Navy. And I went on the Navy, navsource.org, in the archives. I found a guy named Barry Zerpe, who worked in the archives, and he sent me the action report for Salerno, Italy, and for Omaha Beach. There was no action report for Licata, Sicily. And then I went back and forth with Mr. Cressman in the Navy archives, in the Navy Dictionary of American Fighting Ships, to try to get him to convinced that we were there. But it took me from about 51 years going back and forth. Finally, my son gave me a computer, you know, and after I got the computer, I could look up things on Google, and I had definite proof that we were there. And even though we were lend-lease to the British, that might be where we stumbled, the Navy stumbled. But even though they had it in the archives, the Navy wasn't giving us credit for the invasion of Salerno. But I finally got the action report and all of that information. I don't know why Mr. Cressman and the Navy didn't go over to the archives at Adelphi Road and find it from Barry Zerpe, who works there at the archives. But they finally gave us credit for going into Salerno. And I'm satisfied now that we're there, and I'm in the archives.
Now, you're a retired captain, and captain in the Navy is a very prestigious rank.
Yeah.
How long did you stay in the Navy after the war?
The Navy? After the war?
Mm-hmm.
I got out of the Navy. Well, let's see. I got out December the 26th, 1945, so the war was over. World War II was over in April. Was it April 1945?
August is when the Pacific ended. But
I'm talking about early May.
Yeah.
So that was May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. 7 months.
So you had achieved the rank of captain by that time?
No. I when I got out of the Navy, I went to work with Ledbetter Johnson Construction Company. And then I worked there in Fort Payne, Alabama, and I was there for about a year, and I transferred to the Georgia Power Company, putting up power lines and doing drafting work after I went out and did survey work to locate where the power poles and the service for transformers to people who lived out in the rural area of Georgia. And then I decided to join the Army. I sent my Navy rating description book, and I was given a rank of tech sergeant in the Army, which is supply, and I was given a rank of and sent to Craig Field in Selma, Alabama, where I was put on a supply line to dish out supplies for airplanes, and I went to the personnel office and I said, I'm out of sign. I want to go to Mobile, Alabama, and get on an air sea rescue boat, and do rescue work. They said there's no vacancies there, so we'll have to give you the water supply. We had a civilian who quit that. You'll be close to water. And I had three artesian wells, two swimming pools. And then one day, Colonel Crittenden came down. He was an Army in charge of that, Craig Field, Colonel. And he says, would you like to go to officer's training school in the In the Army? I said yes, and I went to Lackland Air Force Base for 9 months, and after that I got commissioned second lieutenant. Prior to that, while we were in training there, I was kicked in the ear, and had a perforated eardrum doing water polo, game of water polo, and that gave me a disability defect. And so we went off on a 15-mile hike in Texas where the ground was cracked. It was so hot and I was soaking wet. And I got a call from the commander of the officer's training school. He said, Cadet Peacock, you can't graduate because you have a perforated eardrum. Frank Sinatra was rejected from the Army because he had a perforated eardrum. And I said, well, I think I went through the World War, you know, in the Navy. And when I went home on leave, he said, you come back and we'll make you the NCOIC of the wardroom here. They'd give me a master sergeant, you know. So I went home on leave, and it happened that my brother's wife's father was a congressman. And he said, why didn't you get commissioned? And I told him. And he says, Carl Vinson was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee then. And he says, well, I tell you what we'll do. You call, give me this phone number. I want you to tell that commander to call this phone number. He said, they knew 3 months before you graduated, and the last day they called you in to tell you that, and you were getting medical treatment 3 months before on your ear, you know, and they should have commissioned you. So I got called over to the ward, and I gave him the commander the phone number, and he called it, and they told him to commission me today, and he commissioned me. So that's second lieutenant.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. All right, we'll take a quick break. One more segment here with the U.S. Navy World War II veteran William Peacock. We'll be right back.
The stories of America's fighting soldiers, sailors, and aviators, unfiltered. Join Gene Pill as an honored roster of guests tell their stories from the front lines of war. Listen to what happened during our nation's times of war from the people who experienced it. Hear it each week on Veterans Chronicles.
Listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, honored to be joined today by World War II U.S. Navy veteran William Peacock, but as we're also learning, U.S. Army veteran William Peacock. He was just explaining how he became an officer in the U.S. Army, and when we hit the break, he was a second lieutenant. So go ahead and finish.
That's
that
right.
Story.
As a second lieutenant, they kept me at Lackland Air Force Base for a couple of months in basic training. And I stayed there watching the basic trainees come in and train, looking for unshined shoes, untied shoes, and unbuttoned buttons and for 2 months. And then they sent me to Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi to go to 49 weeks of airborne electronics school, which I did, and I graduated there, and they wanted to keep me there as an instructor, and I said, I want to go to career. This was close to 1950 when the Korean War started, and I want to go to career so I can put to practice what I've learned in the Airborne Electronics School. So no, you're going to stay here as an instructor. So get you a cookbook, which was a math book, and a slide rule down by my side, and go to hangar so-and-so and pick up a class at 6 in the morning. And I did that. Most of my students were college graduates. So I taught there in that morning class, and then and I rotated to an afternoon class, 12 to 6, and then 6 to 12 again. And midnight, you know, you taught, you were constantly teaching. And I was learning a lot from those. I had guys in there with physics, chemistry, math, and civil engineering. All of my officer students were college graduates, and I kind of wanted to get a college education. So I got promoted to captain while I was there. And in 3 years, I was promoted to captain, and that's where I made captain, teaching electronics fundamentals at Keesler Air Force Base. So I decided to go to Mississippi State College, and I enrolled in a GI Bill at Mississippi State College. And they gave me credit when I went through with there and for 1 year. And in 3 years, I got an electrical engineering degree from Mississippi State College. So it was tough going. It was tough going. But on my summer breaks, I came back to Keesler and taught. They let me come back down there and teach for 3 months in the summer to make more money. You know, I was a GS-7 at that time. So when I finished Mississippi State College, I got a job. I was got the top job of my class, which was $5,333 a year, with General Electric in Utica, New York. So,
nicely done. Nicely done. So, just a couple minutes left in our conversation, and I know you wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about how you and your fellow vets put together regular luncheons to reunite and talk about your experiences.
Yes. Patrick Monahan was a cook on our ship, and his son, Paul Monahan, wanted to find out what his father did. He never found out before his father died. So he sent out emails, and I was one of them to receive it. And these other guys on my ship also got the email and their email address. I contacted them and asked them if we could have a luncheon and meet together at the Olive Garden in Laurel, Maryland. And we did so. So we had that meeting, and then we had another meeting in Tramp Shanty, and we would all talk about what we did in different parts of the ship. And so the thing about it was, Tom Sullivan, who made the three trips and never got a wound, he had a friend who went to horse races with him. And when he went to these horse races, he and Stuart Elbin, who was kind of like his son, he took on to taking Tom as his father. So every time we'd have a luncheon, he would come to the luncheon and bring Tom, no matter where it was. And they went to horse races together all over. And so every time we'd have a luncheon, Stuart would get up and pay for the lunch when he'd go out and play like he was going to the bathroom. But he would pay for the lunch and the tip and everything. So when the waiter came around to give us the bill, he said, "Oh, it was all done, see." And so then I give Paul Monahan credit for getting this started, because when I got everybody together, John Harvey, who was my Sunday school teacher and went to Laurel High School with my son, and it was known as he and his sister were known as the God Squad there, because they were so religious, and he was my Sunday school teacher, and he wanted, because his father was in the OSS in China behind the lines, and I met him and I knew him very well, and he died, and so John kind of wanted to get with us World War II guys. So he would come and sit there, he and his wife Karen Harvey, and they would take moving pictures of us during our conversations and talking about our World War II experience during the dinner. And he made DVDs out of it to give us, you know. And he made the big picture that you have there of the LST on the beach at Salerno. And then Alvin Hess, he's the guy that got the cable.
Right.
I got to give Alvin Hess credit for a lot, because I wasn't going to go in and do all these things. And he came over to my house, he and his wife Helen, for dinner. And while he was there, I had my little notebook. He said, what all did we go to? And I had my little notebook where I logged every place that we went. He said, why don't you type that out and give it to all of us? So I did, and I made a list of all the places, and I gave him the list of the NavSource.org. I gave him a list of the charter members of the ship, and I gave him a list of the dictionary of American fighting ships, and all that information that I gave him, and about my son finding the picture in the archives at the Naval Academy. And and Helen Hess, I tell you about, I'll have to tell you this, at one of our meetings, Tom Sullivan was up on the bow of the ship and off the coast of Sicily, and we had two torpedoes go by us in the front, two in the back, and one I saw coming off the starboard off the starboard beam, went right under the ship, and all those torpedoes missed us, and Tom Sullivan says, "I thought those were porpoises," and Helen said, "There ain't no porpoises in the Mediterranean." So.
All right. Well, sir, it's been an honor to have you with us here today. Thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for sharing it with us today, and God bless you.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.